Good evening. All over the world right now, people in this tradition are sitting sesshin. I always like to think about that. There's a sesshin going on at Chikoji, right up the hill. But many, many, many different places in the Japanese Soto tradition, this is Buddha's Enlightenment Week. So everyone sits real hard. And sometimes ambitious people who think they're going to attain something sit all night, the last night. And come in the morning all kind of shaggy and dazed and happy. I have a couple of little things here to share. There's a letter here from Beth Goldring, who thanks us for our generous donations to Brahma Vihara in Cambodia. And she says, "Your kindness to me at my talk. It is because of the kindness of people like you that we have been able to continue working all these years with the Cambodia AIDS Project. Visiting with you is always one of the truly joyous highlights of my year." And also we have a new sort of Sangha member on Kap Dantibs, am I pronouncing that right, in the south of France, who is an artist. Watercolors, amazing watercolors, who found us on the web and wrote to us. So he sent this wonderful catalog that one also. Oh, it's on the Mediterranean, in the south of France. I meant to look it up, but I haven't done it yet.
Does he want visitors?
Yeah. Well, maybe so. I don't know. It is described in here as a beautiful garden where he lives with his wife, with a fish pond and all beautiful things and. Flowers. It's a lush part of the world anyway, a very, very beautiful part of the world. So he listens to the tapes on the internet and says he paints to the tapes. So it's very amazing and very touching. Beautiful, beautiful work. So I'll leave this out so you all can take a look when it's over. You have a new face tonight. Welcome. How did you hear about us? I see. And we have an old face who hasn't been here for a long, long time. I was just thinking about you yesterday. I was down at Santana Row, and I kept looking around, thinking, where is he? Where is he? Welcome. Some introductions around.
I'm Dan.
Wendy.
Lauren.
Anjo.
Forrest.
Samuel.
Britt.
Russ.
David.
Jane.
Julian.
Wow, this is great. We're reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, kind of starting all over the way you're supposed to in this practice. And we're on chapter, well, they're not numbered. We're on page 55 on the one called repetition. Want to start?
Sure. Repetition. The Indian thought and practice encountered by Buddha was based on an idea of human beings as a combination of spiritual and physical elements. They thought that the physical side of man bound the spiritual side, and so the religious practice was aimed at making the physical element weaker in order to free and strengthen the spirit. Thus, the practice Buddha found in India emphasized asceticism. But Buddha found when he practiced asceticism, there was no limit to the attempt to purge ourselves physically, and that it made practice very idealistic. This kind of war with our body can only end when we die. But according to this Indian thought, we return in another life and another life to repeat the struggle over and over again without ever attaining perfect enlightenment. And even if you think you can make your physical strength weak enough to free your spiritual power, it will only work as long as you continue your ascetic practice. If you resume your everyday life, you will have to strengthen your body, but then you will have to weaken it again and to regain your spiritual power. And then you will have to repeat this process over and over again. This may be too great a simplification of the Indian practice encountered by Buddha, and we may laugh at it, but actually some people continue this practice even today. Sometimes without realizing it, this idea of asceticism is in the back of their minds. Practicing in this way will not result in any progress.
Buddha's way was quite different. At first he studied the Hindu practice of his time and area, and he practiced asceticism. But Buddha was not interested in the elements comprising human beings, nor in metaphysical theories of existence. He was more concerned about how he himself existed in this moment. That was his point. Bread is made from flour. How flour becomes bread when put in the oven was for Buddha the most important thing. How we become enlightened was his main interest. The enlightened person is some perfect, desirable character for himself and for others. Buddha wanted to find out how human beings developed this ideal character, how various sages in the past became sages. In order to find out how dough became perfect bread, he made it over and over again until he became quite successful. That was his practice.
But we may find it not so interesting to cook the same thing over and over again every day. It is rather tedious, you may say. If you lose the spirit of repetition, it will become quite difficult. But it will not be difficult if you are full of strength and vitality. Anyway, we cannot keep still. We have to do something. So, if you do something, you should be very observant and careful and alert. Our way is to put the dough in the oven and watch it carefully. Once you know how the dough becomes bread, you will understand enlightenment. So how this physical body becomes a sage is our main interest. We are not so concerned about what flour is, or what dough is, or what a sage is. A sage is a sage. Metaphysical explanations of human nature are not the point.
So the kind of practice we stress thus cannot become too idealistic. If an artist becomes too idealistic, he will commit suicide, because between his ideal and his actual ability, there is a great gap. Because there is no bridge long enough to go across the gap, he will begin to despair. That is the usual spiritual practice. But our spiritual way is not so idealistic. In some sense, we should be idealistic. At least we should be interested in making bread which tastes and looks good. Actual practice is repeating over and over again until you find out how to become bread. There is no secret in our way, just to practice Zazen and put ourselves into the oven is our way.
I'm hungry.
It's a funny analogy, isn't it? We're cooking. Welcome, Emily. So glad to see you. So how do we become bread? What is bread? How do we feed the world? I had a discussion with a friend the other day, also a teacher, who is wrestling with the question that keeps coming up in practice about what a priest is. And her notion of a priest was someone who has completely cut all basic ties to the world and has vowed to live a completely simple life. And she described it as being separate from the slimy world. And and I was thinking about Shakyamuni Buddha's experience in as Suzuki Roshi is describing it very, very succinctly and very well, how he tried and tried and tried to practice overcoming this slimy world, overcoming the limitations of this very limited body that's so full of bad smells and slimy juices, and it's all falling apart, and it's going to end up in terrible disarray before we're done, to try to transcend. And the most amazing and interesting part of Shakyamuni Buddha's whole journey was that he stopped that effort. He made it for 6 years. Tremendous suffering. And also studied all those different metaphysical practices and succeeded magnificently with his teachers. But as Roshi says here, you just get weak again when you get up. So it's curious to think of him sitting under the tree as putting himself in the oven, but it's a wonderful analogy of being willing to sit down and really cook our life. Meet our life. I told my friend I thought that I always think that our life is two gestures at the same time. One is the wisdom gesture of a kind of sense of perspective and distance, so that we see but we're not completely devastated by the suffering that we see and experience. And the other is the compassion side, which puts us right in the middle of everything. And my view about priesthood is that it's not about living a monastic life of total separation, but being in the middle of it all, being willing to be in the middle of it all. In terms of this cooking process, and in terms of the precepts, practicing the precepts. Other questions? Jane?
The notion of cooking is it's disturbing me a little bit because it sounds like something that I need to do. I like the repetition part and the spirit of repetition because that is a support. And it's the notion of that there's something I need to do. My efforts have been in the opposite direction, to stop doing and to de-emphasize effort and will. And so, I mean, I've heard you say that we're cooked and that life lives us. And I find that very helpful to inhabit that. But to say that I cook my life really feels like it's throwing gasoline on a fire with this person.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet there's some effort that goes into every moment of your life. You bring some effort to the cushion just to get there, and to get there over and over. I think that's what he means. He's talking about and how tedious it is, how boring it is, because we just do it again and again. Or it can be tedious and it can be boring. Unless we allow ourselves to be fresh every time. So you can't say that there's no effort. There is effort. But at the same time, it works the other way as well. We live and we are lived. We effort and we are efforted. Both. And you could define our practice as finding where those meet, where it's happening of itself, of our own volition. It's not that we turn ourself off. No, that the fire of you is important, but we don't pour gasoline on it either. Well, finding that balance is a very important part.
I mean, it's making me think of you know, cooking as a practice where you really do let the ingredients become the dish, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you put it on fire and you add heat to it in time and it becomes the dish. So
yeah.
Maybe it's the same with, okay, what ingredients are here? Maybe that's what he's getting at.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a meeting. Rather than I guess I felt uncomfortable that I'm to transform myself because I've tried that and that doesn't
no,
work.
No, you can't cook yourself or transform yourself. That was Buddha's experience. You know, he tried and tried and tried and nothing worked. It's more thinking.
More.
But if we just sit quietly, it is like bread rising. You know, everything is here, and everything happens, and we just experience it as it happens, however it happens, and it's different every time. And we can't really take credit for any of it. We can't say, oh, my sitting was really good today. Or, I am a really good sitter. doesn't work that way. It's a good question. Julian?
I have a lot of questions actually regarding like the second paragraph. He's saying a lot about Buddha and his and Buddha's way. So he studied Hindu practice and it says he didn't like it. I mean, he found it problematic. And he goes, but Buddha was not there's so many things I have questions about here. He was more concerned about how he himself existed at this moment. That was his point. Bread is made from flour. Just the progression of those sentences is like kind of.
So the idea in the old Hindu idea, things are all made in a kind of heavenly realm. And what he's saying is that it's a very practical, simple, physical experience, our life. That when Buddha finally sat down and faced his mind, he saw that he was living this incredible, fascinating drama where greed and anger and pride and ambition were just crowding his mind all the time. And as he sat, he began to get familiar with it and began to say, I see that. I see that. And little by little began to realize that it was just him sitting right there. Just him as he was. So that finally, at the culmination of enlightenment, he was challenged by his mind, you could say. What makes you think you have a right to this, to be just here like you are, just you? And he said, the earth is my witness. We are earth beings. We don't transcend the earth. We live this life where we are, who we are, just as we are, just flour, just boring bread.
I guess I'm kind of curious as to the difference he saw between, like, sitting, I guess, and, like, the methods of spiritual attainment that he was experiencing previous.
I think he appreciated them very much, but realized that that wasn't it. Even though he wasn't exactly sure what it was. And went out into the forest and lived as a yogi for many years until he finally almost died of starvation. He was down to one grain of rice a day and realized he wasn't going to carry on for very long, and he still hadn't transcended, and so he gave up and bathed and washed himself and ate something and began to return to life. So it wasn't that they were completely wrong, it's just that it wasn't complete. Because it was ideas, it wasn't the experience.
He's in this sentence, but Buddha was not interested in elements comprising human beings, nor, it's again on the second paragraph, nor metaphysical theories of existence. I understand the metaphysical theories of existence. But Buddha was not interested in the elements comprising human beings.
I don't know quite what he means there, okay. Whether he's talking about psychological theories or, you know, that's what I thought of when I read that. You know, how we analyze ourselves to a fairly well. We're always finding one more theory about how we are put together and how we work. And without, you know, often testing it, it's just one more cheap idea, you know, that we put on ourselves.
Okay.
So he finally just said, no more of this fancy thinking. Let's just get more simple.
Okay.
Let's come home to ourselves.
It's interesting the weight of words between like human and then like he was more interested in like enlightenment.
Yes.
And, like, well, I guess because enlightenment, I had baggage of like the different theories,
uh-huh,
the Hindu theories. Anyway,
yes.
Yeah,
like enlightenment is not human. It's when you you drop the humanness. But actually, it's the other way. It's when you take it all in. Dan.
Why is it that I think it's human nature that if someone comes and tells you that the practice is just sitting, and how much simpler could that be? But you, of course, don't believe that. You think there's some secret that somebody's not telling you and all kinds of other stuff. And then after 10 years, you're getting an idea, and 20, you're coming into it. And after 30, you realize, yeah, he was right. It was all just sitting, but not all the other stuff that you build around it. It was all just sitting. It's the famous thing, you know, mountains are mountains at the beginning,
yeah,
and then you mountains are rivers, and then mountains are mountains again. But it takes you going through all those 30 years to realize that the person that told you that was right all along. I can think of numerous examples in regular life, the same thing. You know, they talk to you about, you know, some math idea that you don't understand, and then you go through and you go to college and you derive it all and you realize that they were right all along and it was simple to begin with, and why couldn't you have understood it back then? I think Suzuki Roshi is even he's hinting that the Buddha had to do that. He had to cook bread,
mm-hmm,
as it were, you know.
Yeah.
He had to sit down. Various people have to do things over and over to see the original insight only after they went through the hardship of getting there themselves.
Yes.
My question is why is it that we can't accept it when they tell us the first time? Why do we have to go through the hassle of the 30 years of sitting?
Well, the Hindus would say it's, and then the Advaita would say that it's just the play of the universe, the play of consciousness. It's just how we amuse ourselves. I don't know any better excuse for it than that, really.
It's so interesting. I mean, you could think of so many examples where, you know, a kid learning to drive, I mean, they think it's impossible. How do you do the clutch and remember everything and not get messed up? And then you realize years later when you're driving on these crazy hills in San Francisco, it's not a problem even there. But you got to go through it yourself.
Yes.
So.
Because it's not an idea. You know, the idea is one thing. And we think when we have an idea that we actually know something. But we don't know it until we live it.
So in some sense, the lesson for me from all that is that it's okay to be learning something along the way, because everybody's learning something along the way, because even though we know we should accept it the first time we see it, we can't. We've got to go through the sitting or the baking or whatever.
Yes.
Whatever it is.
It's the joy of our life. Learning new things, engaging with new things over and over again. Sometimes people get discouraged when they're old and think, "Oh, I'm old. I'm no good anymore. I can't learn anything. Old dog, new tricks won't work." But it's not true. They've done many studies now in the last 10 years. They're finding it's absolutely not true. Even very old people can be very vigorous and learn brand new things and contribute greatly to their own lives and to everyone else. It's wonderful. Life can be quite fun, but it means being engaged, physically engaged, really embodied the whole thing.
I sometimes think that's also what the process of dying is, that even that might be the biggest lesson. And one of the reasons why I'm practicing is that to train my mind that I can still take that spirit of inquiry, what is this?
Yes.
Even at the point of death.
Yes. Yes. Very curious. We can be really curious. Who knows? Oh, it's time already. That was fast. Speaking of which, I want to tell you that our friend Tom Both is not in very good situation right now. He's still alive, but he's very ill. And I'm going to see him on Friday. But I'd like to bring you with me in my pocket. He really feels connected to this whole group much more than anything else in his life, and so I hope you all will find some way to wish him well. So we can send all the loving kindness that we can generate in that direction down in South San Jose. Mm-hmm.